Good evening, and welcome to What a World. Celebrating diversity and loving it, this is Nevin Campanella bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge.
Good evening, and welcome to What a World Radio. Celebrating diversity and loving it, this is Nevin Campanella with his gravelly voice, bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge and into the mystical realms of concentric illusions. That's kind of a new word I've thrown in on this show, folks, concentric illusions. What a World Radio has two segments. The first one, which is Sunday nights, is called Concentric Illusions. And the second segment is on Saturday afternoons, and it is called BBS Expeditions. You're going to have to excuse my voice. I don't know how long it'll last. I'm recovering from pneumonia, but we will try to get through the show as best we can. Tonight's radio adventure will be brought to us by Jim Berklin, who will discuss the very difficult problems involved in earthquake prediction. And please join us in our adventure by calling in. Our U.S. toll-free number is 1-888-268-4313. And our international number is 1-530-876-3222. Now, before we get to Jim, there is some interesting news tonight. First of all, it snowed in the San Francisco Bay Area today. That's rather amazing. I've been in San Francisco a number of times. I've never seen it snow there. And also, Claude Allen, who resigned last month, you remember him. He was the top domestic policy advisor for Bush. Guess what, folks? He got arrested this week in Montgomery County for a swindling scheme. I think it had something to do with Target stores. And last but not least, the death of former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic, claiming the day before he was found dead that he was being poisoned. Now, isn't that something? Kind of makes your head spin, doesn't it? You wonder. Well, maybe our next guest can help us stop the spinning in our heads when it comes to understanding what is happening on our planet. Our guest is Jim Berklin. And excuse me, I'm going to wind up coughing in this mic no matter what I do. And he is without a doubt the rebel in the world of geologists. In his own words, he is a country boy who grew up in the Valley of the Moon in Sonoma County, north of San Francisco. But that country boy decided to take on the traditionalist in his field when he noticed that many earthquakes occurred at the time of maximum tidal forces associated with the twice-monthly alignment of the sun and moon. Now, Jim is also very well known for his right-on-the-money prediction of the famous October 17, 1989 World Series quake that rumbled through San Francisco Bay Area. However, and this, folks, his method of forecasting was not exactly received with open arms. And in fact, when he made the forecast for the October 17, 1989 World Series quake, he got into a lot of trouble for it, and I think it may have affected his job. But I'll let Jim tell the rest of that story. Hi, Jim. Welcome to What a World Radio.
Hi, Nevin. It's a pleasure to be here and join you and your audience.
Oh, Jim, you know, I've been associated with you quietly in the background. I've been on your forums, and, you know, I have followed you. I think you've been starting forums since 97. And I've been an avid fan of Jim Berklin since then. Jim, before we get into theories of earthquake prediction, how about telling us a little bit about your background? How did you wind up becoming a geologist, and how did you get to become that maverick?
Yeah, it was really, really strange, because I was a straight arrow all through school, believed everything I heard from the professors and read in the books, and had to have a professional job. I became the first county geologist in Northern California when I took the reins at Santa Clara County in 1973 as their first county geologist. And up until that time, I believed that it was impossible to predict earthquakes because all my professors said so and all my books said so, and I had no reason to doubt it. Earthquakes are random events. And then on, I took the job in September of 1973, and during those first 3 months, we were greeted by, let's see, how many were there? Six earthquakes of 3.2 to 4.8 in the Bay Area. And all I did was note them in the day book, and if I felt a couple of them, and I would get calls from people wondering how big and just, you know, what was the area affected and all that. So, and that was what I do. I'd call Berkeley Seismographic Station or the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park and or Caltech and get information for the southern part of the state. And then on January 8th of 1974, there was an article that appeared in newspapers across the country, and the source was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it was read mainly from their main scientist, Fergus Wood, a genius of an oceanographer and a geophysicist and an astronomer, and he put it all together in a book, about a 1,000-page book called The Strategic Role of Parisian Spring Tides. It just means it was very important when you have the maximum tides related to perigee, which is the closest monthly approach of the moon, and syzygy, which is its twice monthly lining up of the sun, moon, and earth at full moon or new moon. And of course, tomorrow, full moon, is an eclipse of the moon, so it's a perfect syzygy. So the tides are going to be about twice normal. So it opens up an 8-day period that I call a seismic window. But this one, despite the perfect alignment, is not my choice of a window, a seismic window for this month.
Why not, Jim? I mean, considering that we're going to have all that magnetic energy going on, what makes the difference?
Well, it's mainly the gravitational forces and the tide-raising forces. Because it's going to be superseded by what happens on the 29th of March. And that's when we're going to have a total eclipse of the sun, which requires an even more precise alignment of the sun, moon, and earth. The shadow of the moon passing over the earth with the sun behind it is only about 100 miles wide, even though it does travel about 4,000 miles or so. So it's a fairly rare privilege to see a total eclipse of the sun. Any place on the earth usually gets about one such eclipse every lifetime. My section of California hasn't had one during my lifetime. So I've had to travel. I've seen three total eclipses, and they are fantastic events.
I've seen a few in my lifetime.
Oh, wonderful.
They are absolutely amazing. Jim, when you made that prediction, the 89 World Series, as a matter of fact, I was watching television. I was watching the World Series in Candlestick Park, and I watched. You know, at first I thought my damn television was falling off the stand. I watched it, but now, Jim, you had a problem with that. I think you might have gotten suspended. Did you?
Exactly. A lot of people thought I got fired, but that they were looking for means to fire me, and they looked for 2.5 months, and I had an exemplary record, and there was nothing wrong. In fact, I was correct. 4 days before the quake, I said we're going to have a World Series quake of 6.5 to 7 magnitude in the Bay Area. And there's an 85% chance it's going to happen. None of this happened in 30 years with a 30% chance like the USGS had given it. Because I had so many clues. Not only did we have the highest tidal force in 3 years on the 14th of October, but we had whales beaching themselves in San Francisco and Santa Cruz, and it hasn't happened before since. We got live rare whales beaching themselves. We had the prize homing pigeons getting lost. We had the record number of missing dogs and cats. We had the hot spring cooling down and slowing down. We had a geyser slowing down its eruption cycle. We had waterfalls begin to increase their flow. And we had people reporting a deep like explosions in mines up along the San Andreas Fault. There were so many
clues.
Were
you keeping an active record of all these things occurring?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. In fact, starting in 1979, a physicist with Xerox called me, and he said, I agree with your upcoming seismic window, my tide window, because the cats are disappearing again. And I almost hung up on him. He was interrupting my dinner at home, and he had a very strong accent. A great gentleman from Argentina, and I have, you know, met him later, but he said that he looked at the lost and found column in the San Jose Mercury News and noticed that it lengthened just prior to local quakes. And so I said, oh, what quakes have you noticed this for? And he recounted about four quakes that had occurred in 1979, of which I knew well. And I said, well, how long in advance do the cats disappear? And he said, a week to 10 days. And then it takes a few days for people to give up posting notices on telephone poles and driving around the neighborhood and calling kitty kitty and that sort of thing, phoning around. And so they'll finally spend $30, $40, $50 to put an ad in the paper. And that does take days. So by the time it actually shows up in the paper, you're very close to the quake itself.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Well, it did. But my first extreme skepticism was allayed when I realized that our cat, Rocky, had disappeared on my birthday, July 31st, 1979, just 6 days before the strongest earthquake in the Bay Area since 1911. And Rocky was still gone 6 months later when Antonio was calling me. And that's what really made me start to pay attention. Rocky returned after an absence of 6 months, just 4 days before the next 5-magnitude quake in the Bay Area.
Well, you must have wind up calling him your earthquake cat.
Yeah, well, they called him Rocky, and that was pretty good for a geologist cat.
Yeah, I guess so.
But that made a believer out of me, especially when he disappeared just 2 days before the strongest quake in February of 1980. So at that time, I began keeping daily records of the missing dogs, cats, and birds in three different newspapers. And I have all those records in my catalog. And so if anyone wants to know, and they say, oh, this is not scientific, just look at the lost and found column. Yes, it's scientific when you have 20 years of daily records for L.A. and San Francisco and San Jose.
Well,
and so, for example, just before the World Series quake, instead of 3 or 4 missing cat ads, there were 27. Instead of 15 missing dog ads, there were 58. So it has to catch your attention if you've been observing this for 10 years and never saw anything like it before, and together with all these other phenomena. So despite the fact that my colleagues say it's impossible to predict earthquakes and that they've called me a clown, an enthusiast, not a scientist, a crackpot, and so forth. But I've got the record, and I've got the record not only of missing animals, I've got the record of successfully predicting quakes, whereas the U.S. Geological Survey has yet to predict one successfully.
Well, first of all, they seem to refuse to do anything about prediction. But before we get to that, Jim, I eventually want to get down to some basic questions. There's a lot of our audience right now who hear these terms and these words. In a few minutes, I want to cover some of the basics about earthquakes. But before we do that, there is a recent book publication, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes by Cal O'Ray.
Mm-hmm.
What is that book about? And tell us, how can we get a copy of it?
Well, I'd be delighted to. Cal is quite a remarkable author. She is a great pet lover and nutritionist, and has written very successful books about all the benefits of apple cider vinegar and what it's like to be a pet from the pet standpoint. But she has been writing about earthquakes and pets for a number of years, and she started contacting me right out of City College of San Francisco, I guess, is where she was attending. And she had several articles written about me and the animals that I knew about in Cat's World, Dog's World, and Women's World at different times. And then last year, she said, I'd like to write a story about your life and about your theories. And I said, fine, but are you sure you want to do this? Because three other authors had contacted me and started with a bang and then dropped it very quickly when they contacted the academia. And even though I'm a fellow in the Geological Society of America and I've taught universities on the East and West Coast, I've had 10 years of college and university training in geology, when you start predicting earthquakes, you lose a lot of credibility amongst your fellows.
I
had to take that chance. I said, am I going to continue to predict, or am I going to just shut up about it when I have the information? And I said, hey, I'm going to keep on calling it as I see it.
Okay, Jim, I want to stop you for 1 second here and tell the audience, Jim Berkland, in fact, went for a doctor's degree, and he had all but his dissertation. So I just want the audience to know that you are extremely educated. I'm sorry to interrupt, Jim. I wanted to get that in there.
Yes, I actually submitted a 350-page dissertation after 9 years, and they informed me that 7 years was the limit, and I'd have to go back and take my orals all over again, take more courses to bring me up to date. And I realized I didn't really have time or inclination to do that. So I do have a written dissertation, but it's never been accepted. But I've used a lot of the information there for geological work and publications. And so it wasn't a total loss. And so I really don't have any regrets about my life and what has happened, especially since I have a great wife, and our first grandchild was born on the day that Katrina came in. Our little Kara Lonnie came in North Carolina.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember when I called you a couple times and you went out there for Christmas vacation.
Yes.
Well, this book, Jim, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, how do we get a hold of it?
Well, it's just about in all the bookstores. And it can be requested because it's through Sentient Publications. It came out in January. They were told it was good out for Christmas, but it didn't make it. But I would suggest, where I've been getting extra copies, is to go to the Internet and go to Amazon.com, and you can get it there for $11.50 instead of paying $16.95 plus tax at a bookstore. Bookstores are going to hate me, but that's the way to go.
Is there a link to that from your website?
Well, I'm not sure if it goes right to Amazon. Sentient is a little sensitive about that, but, you can get it, someplace. And my website does have a picture of me standing in the big fracture on top of the Santa Cruz Mountains. In fact, that was a very critical day. Two geologist friends and I were up there on a Sunday, and, that's when the picture was taken, and the Channel 4, KRON, TV was up there also, and my friend said, you know, here's the man that predicted that quake. He said, oh yeah, you got any proof of that? And I said, yes, here's the paper. And it came out 4 days before the quake, well, actually 3 days before, because I talked to them 4 days before and predicted it. And he said, oh my, well, leave that here, they're coming back for the next broadcast. And so he put it out on the news, and that's when everything really hit the fan. Up until then, my earthquake predictions were much more low-key, and it was like he said he predicted it. He claims he predicted it. Well, there it was for all to see, and this riled up my professional colleagues, and they wanted me fired, and they went to the state geologist who came down upon the county and said, you're responsible for this crackpot, and you know, he's panicking the public, and you better do something about it. And that's when I got suspended. Supposed to be for several days, and it turned into several months. And when I finally got to come back to work on the 10th of July, as 10th of January in 1980, I was told that I had to promise I wouldn't predict any more quakes on county time. And so I did, started up my newsletter at that point. And now I've been publishing monthly newsletters of Syzygy, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, 195 of them, and that's been my major ever since I retired in 1994. My major outside work has been keeping going with my Syzygy, and then starting my website in 1997.
Well, how does a person go about getting a hold of your newsletter?
Well, it's very simple. They'll send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. Put in a buck or two just to keep me going. I've got some extra newsletters. In fact, the last 2 months I had some extra copies made, and I'll be happy to send them along to your listeners. And my address is quite simple. It's Jim Berkland, B-E-R-K-L-A-N-D, Bjerkland, Norwegian extraction, And I live at, well, you can address me at P.O. Box 1926. 1926 is 4 years before I was born. And it's in the little town of Glen Ellen, where Jack London grew, and not, he didn't grow, but he, let's say, he matured as an author here, and then he died here. It's Glen Ellen, G-L-E-N, capital E-L-L-E-N, California, and the zip is 95442. That's P.O. Box 1926, Glen Ellen, California, 95442. And make sure it's a business size self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll get a copy of the late newsletter off to the people that request it.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I think you must have achieved fame, Jim, because you know you're in Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia.
Yes, that's pretty correct. It's not too much I would change there.
I'll tell you what, I've got a little problem with it. I'm a follower of yours, and I really object to Wikipedia when they use the word claim.
Yes, that follows me. It's just, and it really bothers me where a reporter has talked to me, and then when the quake happens, he says he claims that he made the prediction. And come on, they're just not willing to support it.
Yeah,
it's quite clear. That's why the Gilroy Dispatch, just a small article in page 2, said, "Is World Series quake coming?" And that Jim Berkland is not just thinking about the upcoming World Series, but he's thinking about the high tides that from the sun, moon, and earth lining up that might trigger a quake. I told them 6.5 to 7, and they said, "Oh, we haven't had one like that, you know, for about 80 years, and it might scare some people. So let's just limit it to a 6. Okay, well, I said, if they get ready for a 6, they'll be ready for a 7, pretty much. And so what did happen, I still am getting letters from people saying, thank you for that warning. I packaged up my goods, and I got to make sure my batteries were intact. We had extra water, and we had a lantern when the power went off. And I just found out from Lockheed, and the Lockheed engineer called me a couple of years ago. He said, I probably should have called you sooner, but I wanted to wait until he retired from Lockheed. He said, when I heard about your prediction, I went to the boss and said, you know, we've got all these rocket parts just laid out in the green room here for final inspection, and they're kind of vulnerable to shaking. Shouldn't we kind of tie things down? And his boss said, forget it. I checked with the U.S. Geological Survey, and they said Berkland doesn't know what he's talking about. But this guy, Tony Bell, said, it sounded logical to me, so I did batten down the hatches. We did not lose a single part, and the rocket went off on schedule a month later, and you saved Lockheed several $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it's nice to know. It would have been better to know when I was on suspension. But it does explain why that following summer, my wife and I got invited to the Lockheed annual picnic.
Uh-huh. Would you have any objection to me writing to Wikipedia and making a complaint about that damn word?
Oh, I'd love to see you do that. Sure, I'd be a little reluctant to do it myself.
Oh no, you don't need to. Listen, Jim, you have many, many supporters, and I've got my own problems with USGS. I'm going to cover that with you too. If my voice holds out.
Oh boy, down at Yucca Mountain, how about that? A disaster, and that misleading papers that they wrote about how not to worry about earthquakes and groundwater.
Oh yeah, I mean these people are terrible. There are so many problems going on with USGS, it would take us 2 shows just to list them.
I did work for them for 6 years and had great admiration for the amount of effort they put in, you know, working up until midnight and really involved, working weekends. But I did run into these bureaucratic problems.
Oh, well, Jim, it's constant throughout government. I got one of the first simple questions I have for you. Is back in 1997, what stimulated you to develop a forum? I mean, all of a sudden this message board from Jim Berkland appears. What stimulated you to do that?
Well, I felt, because I was so limited in how I could get the word out to the public, I had the newsletter going out to about 350 people. But the newspapers stopped calling me, the magazines stopped calling me, and the TV and radio people stopped calling me because it was like him or us. One beautiful little gal was a producer of a television show over out of Hayward, and she called me and said, I would like you to be on a TV show that I'm setting up on earthquakes and earthquake safety, and I'd like you to appear with the people from the colleges and Stanford and University of California and U.S. Geological Survey. And I said, well, that's just fine with me, but you may find a problem at the other end. And she said, well, I don't see how. And so 3 days later, she phoned me back and she said, Jim, I've never seen such resentment in my life. They tell me they absolutely refuse to be on you and on the same show with you. So I said, well, you have an hour-long show. Why don't you have a first half hour, half hour for me and my friends, and then another half hour for High Science to do their thing. And that's what she did, and she had an award-winning show.
Well, sometimes, Jim, people are so frightened to move away from what is politically correct. And my friend, you have been caught up in this crossfire for years.
I read it again and again, like on this Body Electric, by Dr. What's his name? He worked with the government and showed how you could heal bones and even osteomyelitis by wrapping with silver foil around the area and have a small direct current pass over it. And it was working quite well. And then suddenly his contract ran out, and they had another contract. He was going to, help in the case of the soldiers, as you think the War Department would really be interested in something like this. He and his small group of investigators was turned down. And a month later, he got a call from the winner, who was the son of one of the generals that was doing the research, setting up this program. And this fellow had the gall to ask the doctor, to pick his brains a bit about how he was doing it.
Well, yeah, they don't want to, they will steal. There's no question about it. One of the major goals of BBS Radio, produced by Donald Newsom, is to get this kind of information out there. Don is very, very committed to making sure that people have an alternative news source. And that's what BBS Radio is all about, and that's why I wanted you on the show. If for nothing else, to demonstrate to everyone out there that, yes, we trust Jim Berkland, and no, we do not trust USGS.
Well, last night, my wife and I went to the dinner for Project Censored out of Sonoma State University. I've been one of the reviewers, where we get these items that are under-publicized, very important information for the public, whether it's medical or military, you name it. But articles that should be given broader recognition and haven't been. And so we vote on how important these articles are, and they take the top 25 and publish them every year. And it's been for 30 years now. And they've had some physical threats for attacking, pointing out the facts about the number of organizations and the things that have happened. So I was pleased that last night the director mentioned me. There were over 200 people at this dinner, and it was quite a nice affair. Made me feel good that my wife was there to hear it. Sometimes she wonders about me.
Jim, excuse me. I'm trying to keep my throat clear here.
Any cough drops?
Listen, let's get down to the discussion boards. There's you have a number of chat room boards. The very first one that people come across is called Earthquake Sensitives. Why don't you explain to the audience what that means?
Yes, this is something else. Once I learned that animals were sensitive, that took a little while to accept that. Each stage that I've gone through on this, I'm skeptical at the outset, just healthy skepticism. And then if it's demonstrated that it works, I come to the theory that if it works, use it. And so I continue to do that. I have 10 different methods that an earthquake prediction that are available to most people if you just are observant and pay attention to what other people are saying. I heard about a psychic person that she could predict earthquakes, and she was called the Earthquake Lady. She predicted a number of earthquakes to the USGS. And she had an FM radio station in Santa Clara, I guess it was, in 1974. That was the first year, full year, that I began to predict. I hit 6 out of 8 that year, and the largest quake was a 5.3 quake called the Thanksgiving Day Quake. Now, that's quite a story, because the night before, I attended a meeting of the USGS Pick and Hammer Club, an informal beer-drinking group where they bring up some new ideas and kick them around and sometimes turns up as useful papers. But I'd seen at the library that day that they were having this meeting on earthquake prediction, and they had 3 regularly scheduled speakers. So I quickly assembled my data and asked if I could speak and make my first public earthquake prediction. And the moderator said yes at first, but the 3 speakers were still going after 10:45 at night. The meeting was supposed to be over at 10. So the moderator said, Jim, this next month, we'll catch you then. And I said, this is really hot. Just give me 5 minutes. No, I'm sorry. So I handed out copies of my prediction. I made 10 Xerox copies, and I wasn't able to discuss it to the group. But I did discuss it with the professor from San Jose State University, who was my former thesis advisor when I got my master's degree. And he and I had driven to the meeting. And on the way there, I regaled him with my theory. And on the way back, we said, it's too bad I wasn't able to make a prediction. He said, yes, at a meeting on earthquake prediction, it's too bad nobody actually made one. I know you were ready. So the next day, I took my daughter, it was Thanksgiving Day, and I took my daughter to the movies, get away from all the turkey picking and preparation that my Canadian-born wife was doing for Thanksgiving Day. And I had a 6-year-old daughter at the time. And so we drove to the movies, and while we were in the movies, that 5.3 quake hit, came rolling through Santa Clara Valley and through Century 21, where my daughter and I thought it was part of the special effects of the first run of the movie Earthquake. That sense around was really something. So I came out 20 minutes later after the quake, and the movie was over, and I came out to the car and turned on the car radio and heard about this quake that was felt from Monterey to Santa Rosa to Modesto. And at first I thought, wait a minute, I just saw Los Angeles destroyed. Who is this, Orson Welles on the radio? Oh, it's a real quake. Then I glanced at my watch. The quake wasn't supposed to happen until after midnight, and it was 3:01 when it happened. So I was 9 hours off. And my critics say that was a total miss. There's the strongest quake in the Bay Area in about 5 years.
Because 9 hour miss.
9 hours off, and so that's a miss. And I said, look, it's at least a 90%. You can't call it a total miss. So when you get any prediction, has to have time, place, and magnitude, and you should give probability so people can see how strong you'll believe in your own ideas. And so my predictions are usually from 70 to 85%. It's rare that I go 85%. I have to really be confident.
We have a mutual friend, Charlotte King.
Yes.
Who
I've met her. I've been on a show with her.
Yeah, she's, matter of fact, she's been on my show a number of times. When I talk to Charlotte, it seems as if she is in a constant state of some kind of pain.
Yes.
And I don't know how the lady lives with this. I mean, truthfully, it's like, it never stops, but she has been able to associate pain in different areas of her body with different areas of the planet in terms of quakes. And that is absolutely amazing.
Well, I know that there are physiological effects when you're close to the quake. And I myself get rings and buzzes in the ears, which I used to discount as just a change in blood pressure until a young fellow called me about his own rings. And his parents said, yes, he's been predicting quakes for several years. And then he started calling me, and he was right on the money, about 80, well, more than 80%.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they can be so accurate. Charlotte predicted the Mount St. Helens.
Yes, I understand.
And, you know, why the government will not use this data is beyond me.
Well, they used to encourage Clarissa Bernhardt, the psychic lady, the earthquake lady, to call them. And she hit several right on the money, including that Thanksgiving Day quake. She said it's going to happen. Don't put your turkey on until after 3 o'clock because it's liable to bounce off the table. And so I had predicted it based on the eclipse of the moon that was happening in the next day and the high tides that had already started. And the fact that it was a long lag time since the last five. Plus, at that time, 74, I didn't know about the animals. But I'd heard about some cattle. A fellow who worked on a ranch, he said they went absolutely bonkers before the quake. And were kicking up their heels and their tails in the air and running all around. We thought the mites were getting to them. We're going to have to spray them.
Yeah, you have a wonderful name for that on your website called Seismic Centuries. I love that.
Yes. They're watching out for us, and we just have to understand and interpret. So I say Mother Earth has many messages for us about earthquakes, and the animals are often our interpreters.
You also have on your website something that I'm totally confused by, and this is where I want you to clear up. What the heck is precursor signals on the radio bands?
Yeah. Well, this is another thing that several people are into, and now there was just a big thing on the news this last week about some scientists that have observed what I've been noting and other people have for many years. There are extremely low-frequency radio signals coming from the Earth prior to quakes. As the ground begins to shift and the pressures build up, quartz minerals, for one, are triboluminescent, which means as the grains are rubbed, they emit light, and they also affect radio signals. You may have heard of earthquake lights. Often before a large earthquake, there will be these strange lights in the sky like aurora. And it's fairly rare, but the Japanese have actually taken pictures of them.
Is this, Jim, is this what they refer to as earthquake clouds?
No, entirely different.
Oh, okay.
The clouds I'm a little more reticent to accept. There are a number of people that look at it, but we have so many different kinds of clouds. I've yet to see those that are consistent, because different people have different interpretations as to what is an earthquake cloud. So I think there should be an exhibit, photographs, and then show us what kinds of earthquakes follow. But I certainly don't put it down. I just say I'm a little in my gray basket here, as Stan Friedman, the ufologist, often says. So what happens also is that in the ground, there are trace minerals, minor minerals, in all kinds of rocks. And the most highly magnetic natural substance on Earth is this little black crystal of magnetite. And it's found especially in like lava. Sometimes it's really rich. And if you go to Hawaii and you see the black sand beaches, put a magnet near it, and boy, your magnet will get covered with these little grains.
Uh-huh.
And if you have magnetite in kind of lumps that's naturally magnetic, it's actually called lodestone, and that's what they use for compasses and helping to make steel show where north is. But it wasn't until the late 60s that they began to find magnetite in iron bacteria. Little teeny grains of magnetite in these little one-celled critters, and they look at these, you know, thousands of these little critters under a microscope, and they'd all line up when a magnet was brought near. Well, then they discovered in the early 70s that homing pigeons had magnetite behind their eyeballs. I used to raise homing pigeons here in Glen Ellen.
Yeah, matter of fact, I also raised white Belgians myself.
Ah, well, I had mainly silver kings, but once I took them in a knapsack and hiked about 3 miles up to the top of the mountain here in the Yakima Mountains, and I could see my house off in the distance, took the pigeons out of my knapsack and tossed them into the air. And instead of flying straight home, I told my sister I was going to release them at 2 o'clock, see what time they got home. Well, they got home in about 2 minutes. But what amazed me, instead of flying home, what do pigeons do when you release them? at a ball game or just if you're having a race or something, maybe thousands of pigeons in a pigeon race, instead of flying in different directions directly towards their loft, what do the whole group of pigeons do? It's even at a ball game, at a stadium, they release a flock of pigeons. They circle.
They always circle.
Maybe five or six times.
Yeah.
Why are they doing this? It's so simple. The little grains of magnetite behind their eyeballs are breaking lines of magnetic flux that surround the Earth. And if you have a magnetic material moving around in a magnetic field, you get electric current. And that's what a generator is in a car. You have a magnetic material moving around the magnetic field or the other way around, and that generates electric impulses. So the pigeons create this tiny little electric current, and their little pea brain knows where north is, and they know what it's like to fly home. That's how simple it is. Just before, there's been a big solar flare, the pigeon racers know full well not to have the race. They'll cancel the race if there's been a big solar storm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
First of all, you lose a lot of expensive birds. So
that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes there is no solar storm, and they still lose a lot of birds, and what they call it a smash race. And I was working closely with a pigeon master in Morgan Hill, and Nick Corini. He had been a pigeon master for more than 30 years, an officer in the local club, and he had a prize bird, roving gal. She was worth several $1,000s, and everybody wanted eggs from roving gal. The night before the World Series quake, he was out feeding his pigeons. Roving gal flew right over his shoulder and out into the open blue sky and was gone. She didn't return for a week. She came back a week after the quake. And he said she looked like she'd flown 1,000 miles. She'd lost a lot of weight and she was dirty and ruffled, but she came home after the quake. So, he said, you know, if you're really interested, the worst smash race was years and years ago. We only got 10% of our birds back, and we never could figure out why. And I said, see if you can do it. So he went back through all of his record books, and, you know, they get the humidity and the temperature and average velocity of the birds and everything they could about it, the heritage. So about a week later, Nick called me up. You still interested in that date? And I said, I sure am. He said it was March 24th. 1964, and I got chills up and down my spine like I'm getting right now just thinking about it. That was 3 days before the strongest earthquake ever measured in North America.
Yeah.
The Alaskan quake of 1964, March 27th, Good Friday, and it happened to be the day of the full moon, just as was the big quake in Sumatra in December 26th, you know, in 2004, and the big tsunami. Some 80-foot high tsunami. So the last two 9-magnitude quakes with big tsunamis both occurred on the day of the full moon. And my critics say that's just coincidence.
Yeah.
Well, the biggest aftershock of that tsunami in Sumatra was 3 days after the March full moon in the window. As I mentioned, we're having a partial lunar eclipse tomorrow. The last eclipse we had was the annular eclipse of the sun last October 3rd. And on the 7th of October, our time, the Pakistan quake hit. And that solar eclipse was over Pakistan. Back in 1999, we had a solar eclipse pass all the way across the Atlantic, southern England, France, Italy, Turkey, and India. And I had noticed the Turkey and India pass. And I warned people that they were really under the gun. And it indeed, Izmit, Turkey, shook with a mighty quake that killed 30 or 40,000 people just 6 days after that eclipse passed over Izmit. So I see there's a pattern here. The San Fernando quake in 1971 was on the day of the eclipse of the moon. The 1933 Long Beach quake, which I just missed as a little kid there, because my parents moved us away from there about 2 months before that quake. I don't know if they knew something, but on the day of the eclipse.
Well, you know, that quake in 64, I was living in northern Utah at the time, and we felt it in Cache Valley.
Well, it affected water levels, and also there was a quake in Nebraska, I think, that afternoon or the next day. And that quake caused fluctuations in water wells down in Georgia and South Carolina of about 30 feet. The water sloshed up and down as the ground waves moved past. So there were huge effects from these large earthquakes, which have been kind of overlooked by a lot of my colleagues until about 10 years ago. They would deny that a big quake in Northern California had anything to do with the big quake followed a few days later in Southern California, and vice versa. Oh, well, they're just random events. One quake has nothing to do with another. Now they accept you can have triggering forces.
Well, you're jumping the gun on me here. I have that question for you coming up, which is, why do they refuse to see the relationship between earthquakes when they start occurring as a kind of rhythm, within hours and days of each other?
Well, they've been forced into accepting that after the 1994 Landers quake, 7.5 down in the California desert.
Yes.
Because within minutes, well, within 2 hours, there was a 6.8 quake at Big Bear about 50 miles away. And that, was a little coincidental, different fault and a different kind of a geologic setting. But still, the quake obviously was triggered. But that Landers quake, July of 1994, while my wife and I were in China, and the Chinese accept the tides and quakes for sure, and animals and quakes. We were over waiting to get into the Forbidden City, and somebody said, "You hear about the big quake in Southern California?" And I said, "Oh, how big? A 6? No, 7.5. I said, "Oh, my gosh." But it was just the day before the eclipse of the sun, so I wasn't too surprised. And that quake caused small quakes to occur at Mammoth Lakes on the California-Nevada border, and Mount Lassen, before Mount St. Helens, it was the last active volcano in the 48 states. It caused small earthquakes up in Yellowstone Park. Caused a 5.3 quake a couple days later over in western Utah, and it caused a 5.5 magnitude quake within about 15 miles of Yucca Mountain, where the nuclear repository is supposed to be. And we were all assured there would be no such quake within 100 miles of Yucca Mountain. So that's already been disproven. Well, here was the interesting thing for me. When a spokesman for the U.S. Geological Survey somewhat shamefacedly said, "Well, it does look as if no doubt that the Landers quake triggered these quakes all around the West." And that was surprising because the amount of energy from the seismic waves passing through Mammoth Lake was less than the energy of the full moon passing overhead. And that's great because I don't need less than the full moon. I'll just take the full moon.
Take your right, right. This brings up an interesting topic, and it's on the net constantly. There is a lot of talk on the net regarding the USGS and covering up data.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how to answer that question, but I'll tell you, a few years ago, what I did at a personal level is I took the data that was available on the net, and I tried to run an analysis of variance across years. I wanted to find out, could I find any significant difference from year to year in terms of, first, the number of quakes and the intensity? I did it on both. When I did the analysis of variance by year, I did not find any difference. But when I grouped them into blocks of 5 years, the analysis of variance on their data did demonstrate a significant difference between those groups. So, it was confusing to me because I'm looking at it and I'm saying, why the hell should grouping of the data make that much difference? So something had to be occurring in my mind with the data. So it made me, I started becoming suspicious.
Well, you might want to look at, sunspot cycle.
Well, I didn't have all information available to me.
But well, that's readily available. In fact, the low was 2001, and the next high, and get ready for this, 2012. You know about 2012?
Oh, that's the big number.
That's the big number.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't go on the web anymore without hearing about 2012.
That's a good advice. Interestingly, when I was about 40 years old, somebody got me a meeting with a fortune teller, and she told me things that looked like she had something going for her. And then she says, you know, I see that you will become psychic when you're 82 years old. Well, I'm going to become 82 in 2012.
Wow. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Okay, Jim, I want you to answer a question. Do you think there's a cover-up?
There have been many cover-ups. And the biggest one is the cover-up of the deaths in 1906, and I came upon the truth of that in 1979. Interviewed five survivors in the early 80s and late 79, and then tried to publish a paper on it, and nobody would accept it. This is too speculative. We have the official numbers. And I said, oh, which do you like, the 277 dead or the 315 or the 452 or the 478?
Yeah, which one?
There were 5 or 10,000 or more died in San Francisco at that earthquake and fire. And they successfully covered up because they wanted to not discourage reinvestment, rebuilding,
yeah,
and loss of this military and social and economic center of the Pacific Coast.
It always comes down to the dollar, doesn't it?
Yes. And I said, here's the thing that finally showed me how right I was. Because if I'd been a city geologist and heard from Teddy Roosevelt and Mayor Schmitz and Governor Pardee and everybody else, the government officials, Jim, that was terrible, terrible tragedy. Do you think it could happen again in 10 years? No. 50 years? Maybe. How about 100 years? Now, that's possible. That's more likely. Well, it's a long time away. We won't even be here. We have to work to the living and do what's best for the living here, and that is to restore confidence. So let's minimize the earthquake, play up the fire, because everybody understands fire, and minimize the deaths, because that is how disasters are generally rated.
It kind of reminds me of the movie Jaws, where the...
Yes, oh, know, my yes.
Yeah, you know, here's the mayor. He's seen the dead bodies, but he still wants to keep the beach
open. That's right. Well, in the movie Earthquake,
yes,
they go to the mayor of Los Angeles, because this young gal is saying it looks like a big quake happening from our instruments and the recording in the trenches. And he said, I can't go to the governor with this. He's not even in the same party. So
politics.
Yeah.
It plays all the time. Well, you know, Jim, they are using tidal waves to predict earthquakes. That's not from Jim Berkland. That's historic. I mean, that comes out of ancient times.
Wait a minute. Tidal waves, no. Well, if you're referring to ocean tides, which are indeed tidal waves, tsunami are not tidal waves.
They're not.
Yeah, no. They're resulting in movement up and down on the seafloor. And so they don't relate to tides at all. If the San Andreas, where it does go underneath the ocean,
yes,
if it slipped 20 feet, nothing would happen in terms of tidal waves or tsunami. And the reason is it's a strike slip fault where things move sideways. If things move up and down, that's a different story. And you can just picture you have a dishpan just filled with water, and in the bottom is a big platter. You pick that up by the edge and you pull it out, no problem. But you pick it straight up, pull it up to the surface, and you create a big wave that topples over the whole basin. So that's what happens with a tsunami. The ground moved underneath the sea about 47 feet for the Alaskan quake.
Well, Jim, we're kind of running out of time. Before I say goodbye to you, what is your forecast for earthquakes in the next few months?
Well, we've got a big problem coming up on the 29th of May, March.
What kind of problem are you predicting?
I'm saying about the total eclipse of the sun passing across the Atlantic under the bulge of Africa, across Libya, into the eastern Mediterranean near the Holy Land, which has already got all its problems. It's going to go around Iran and Caspian Sea and ending up over in Mongolia.
How big are we talking about?
there should be at least a 7-magnitude quake associated with that. And plus California is probably going to have at least a 5-magnitude, hopefully out the desert or off in the ocean somewhere. The odds are, just go back in time. In 1978, Iran had a total eclipse of the moon in the sky, and it shook with a 7.6 quake that killed 25,000 people in Iran at Tabat.
Mm-hmm.
And I had friends that went to see a total eclipse of the sun in Java about 1983, and I got a postcard from them. Jim, you won't believe it. The sky darkened, and then the ground shook. And I went down to see Machu Picchu and see the total eclipse of the sun in Peru in 1994. The Peruvian guide stopped outside the lodge before we got to Machu Picchu, and she said, "I am so glad you were all able to see our eclipse. We in Peru have a tradition. We watch the eclipse, and then we wait for the earthquake."
Huh.
And I said, "Whoops, would you say that again for my video camera?" Totally caught me by surprise.
Yeah,
the Chinese know it. Back in Eastern North, my wife was from Eastern Canada, New Brunswick. They had a 5.9 quake on the 9th of January, 1982. And it was the strongest quake there in 126 years. It occurred on the day of the eclipse of the moon, when the Bay of Fundy tides were 55 feet. So I went back to the university and stopped there seeing my wife's folks and all, and went to a geologist there and said, "I'm Jim Berkland, a geologist from California, and I have an idea about the timing of quakes in general and yours in particular." And he interrupted. He says, "Well, it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon when we had these extremely high tides in the Bay of Fundy. We think that that extra stress triggered a weak place in the fault." And I said, "That's my idea. Would you please come to California and talk to some of my colleagues who can't seem to see that simple relationship?"
Yeah, and they won't, Jim.
Listen. Well, they are. Yeah, they're being forced to. Now, my book is the first giant step in that direction. I put nothing but facts in there from my standpoint. And we have some of my critics' words in there, too. And people can weigh the difference if they wish.
Jim, we are out of time. I'm going to be running over here in a second. I want to thank you for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. I have to say goodbye to you now, Jim. And again, thank you for giving us such a wonderful presentation.
Great.
And that ends our Sunday night adventure, folks. Until next time, this is Nevin Campanella wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Goodbye.
The Face on the Barroom Floor by H.A. D'Array, and read by Nevin Campanella. 'Twas a balmy summer evening, and a goodly crowd was there, which well nigh filled Joe's barroom on the corner of the square. As songs and witty stories came through the open door, a vagabond crept slowly in and posed upon the floor. "Where did it come from?" someone said. "The wind has blown it in." "What does it want?" another cried. "Some whiskey, rum, or gin? Here, Toby, sick 'em. If your stomach's equal to the work, I wouldn't touch him with a fork. He's filthy as a Turk." This bandage the poor wretch took with stoical good grace. In fact, he smiles, as though he thought he struck the proper place. "Come on, boys, I know there's kindly hearts among so good a crowd. To be in such good company would make a deacon proud. Give me a drink, that's what I want. I'm out of funds, you know. When I had cash to treat the gang, this hand was never slow." "What? You laugh as though you thought this pocket never held a sou. I once was fixed as well, my boys, as any one of you. There, thanks. That braced me up nicely. God bless you, one and all. Next time I pass this good saloon, I'll make another call. Give you a song? No, I can't do that. My singing days are past. My voice is cracked, my throat's worn out, and my lungs are going fast. Say, give me another whiskey, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll tell you a funny story, and a fact, I promise, too. That I ever was a decent man, not one of you would think, but I was, some 4 or 5 years back. Say, give me another drink. Fill her up, Joe. I want to put some life into my frame. Such little drinks to a bum like me are miserably tame. 5 fingers there. That's the scheme. Ah, and corking whiskey, too. Well, here's luck, boys. Landlord, my best regards to you. You've treated me pretty kindly, and I'd like to tell you how I came to be the dirty sot you see before you now. As I told you, once I was a man with muscle, frame, and health, but a blunder ought to have made considerable wealth. I was a painter, not one that daubed on bricks and wood, but an artist, and for my age was rated pretty good. I worked hard at my canvas, and was bidden pair to rise, for gradually I saw the star of fame before my eyes. I made a picture, perhaps you've seen. It is called the Chase of Fame. It brought me £1,500 and added to my name. And then I met a woman. Now comes the funny part. With eyes that petrified my brain and sunk into my heart. Why don't you laugh? 'Tis funny that the vagabond you see could ever love a woman and expect her love for me. But 'twas so, and for a month or two her smiles were freely given, and when her loving lips touched mine, it carried me to heaven. Boys, did you ever see a woman for whom your soul you'd give, with a form like the Milo Venus, too beautiful of view? With eyes that would beat the coronor, and a wealth of chestnut hair? If so, 'twas she. Well, there never was another half so fair. I was working on a portrait, one afternoon in May, of a fair-haired boy, a friend of mine who lived across the way, and Madeline admired it, much to my surprise, said that she'd like to know the man that had such dreamy eyes. It didn't take long to know him, and before the month had flown, my friend had stole my darling, and I was left alone. And ere a year of misery had passed above my head, the jewel I had treasured so had tarnished and was dead. That's why I took to drink, boys. Why, I never saw you smile. I thought you'd be amused and laughing all the while. Why, what's the matter, friend? There's a teardrop in your eye. Come on, laugh like me. It's just only babes and women that should cry. Say, boys, if you give me just another whiskey, I'll be glad, and I'll draw right here a picture of the face that drove me mad. Give me that piece of chalk with which you marked a baseball score. You shall see the lovely Madeline upon the barroom floor. Another drink, and with chalk in hand, the vagabond began to sketch a face that might buy the soul of any man. Then, as he placed another lock upon the shapely head, with fearful shriek he leaped off and fell across the picture, dead.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.